Hi, I'm Kumi Taguchi and I host a TV show in Australia called Insight, which is unlike any other.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Every week in the same room, we have dozens of guests telling their stories about one shared issue.
There definitely was three people in my marriage.
I started an affair with this man.
From sex and relationships to health, wealth and grief.
Dad, there's been a shooting at the elementary school.
And there's always a guest whose story stays with me.
I actually had guilt for not killing someone.
And I'm left feeling there's so much more I want to ask them. I often wonder, where are they now? So that's what I do here. I go back and I dig a little deeper. This is Insightful. In this episode, I'm catching up with Bill Edgar, also known as, and this is a strange one, the Coffin Confessor. Here's Bill on an Insight episode called Deathbed Goodbyes and Confessions.
In short, I crash funerals on behalf of the deceased. It could be at the funeral, the wake, the will reading, or it could be a private message to somebody delivered face to face. It's not a job for anybody. It takes a little bit of nerve. It's good, bad, funny and sad. There's quite a range of funerals that I've crashed.
Yes, Bill crashes funerals, not weddings, and says stuff people often don't want to know about or hear. Not everyone on the show was a fan of his work. Here's psychologist Amanda Gordon.
Why is it okay for someone who is now dead to wreak havoc and cause horrible outcomes for other people? If you don't have the courage to do it while you're alive, it just sounds capricious and I really don't see any good in it.
I wanted to chat to Bill again because, well, I've never met anyone like him and never met anyone who does a job like his. Bill, it is so great to see you again. Did you feel a little bit like the villain when you appeared on that episode of Insight?
Hi, Kumi. Thanks for having me. Did I feel like the villain? Yeah, I did. I felt, oh, no, this is a setup. I've been set up big time. But as it progressed, I was quite happy. And at the end, I was elated that so many came up and said, you know, we now understand what you do. We get it.
It's such a strange job. And is it true that you're the only person, not in Australia, but in the world, who has this kind of job?
Yeah, I'm it. The coffin confessor, the only one on the planet. So, yeah, I'm pretty proud of that.
Can you patent your job? Can you say, this is my job, no one else can do it?
I have done that.
Really?
And trademarked it and everything else across the planet. You can patent and trademark the idea and the name. But I got to the point where I'm so well known as the coffin confessor now, it doesn't really matter who starts what. And I don't mind anybody that does, to be honest with you, because anybody could be a coffin confessor by turning up to a funeral of a loved one. And if they don't like what they hear, stand up, say something.
I was looking at some of the online comments people were making after the show. A lot of people were saying things like, I'm going to use this guy for my funeral. Is that the kind of feedback you mostly receive?
Oh, absolutely. That and resumes.
Resumes?
Yeah, I got hundreds,
really?
If not thousands
so
of resumes.
What does the email say with the resume attachment?
I need the job. I want to do what you do. I can do it. I have what it takes. A lot of people will actually say that they've got more front than Myers. But yeah, I think to be a coffin confessor, it's more than just being arrogant and the biggest prick on the planet. It's more about being, you've got to be professional. Definitely, you've got to have respect for the person that's passed. I have no care or concern for those left behind. However, I make sure that what I do is basically all for the client in the box. You know, that's it.
So you get an email or an inquiry and someone says, I want you to do this at my funeral, and then you start a conversation from there?
Basically, yes. The last few that I've had have actually come from palliative nurses in care of somebody, and they'll reach out to me on behalf of the person that's dying, and I can either go meet with them face-to-face or we start dialogue by emails, texts, and then videos. Most times, though, I'd rather go down and meet the actual client face-to-face and sit with them, talk with them. I video all my clients. I make sure there's a contract, a video, and I have the right and the authority to do what I do.
So that if there's backlash, potentially after the confession, or if family members or friends say,
did they really say that? You have evidence to say, yes, this is what they wanted.
Yeah, and that's for my own protection as well, so I don't get litigated. But at the same time, I could do a home sweep where I'm going into somebody's home who's in hospital and I have to remove certain items and bring them back to that person or destroy them. Now, I can't do a break and enter, so they give me the keys to enter that property. Or they give me a description of where to find access to that home and enter and retrieve those items. So I have to make sure that it's all legal and above board.
So there might be items in the home which would reveal something about someone's life that they don't want found after they've passed?
Oh, absolutely. My first home sweep ever, actually, he was an 88-year-old man that had a sex dungeon in his home, and he had three sons that were going to go to his house and clean it out. And he was mortified that they would find things like that. And he just wanted it, everything collected and incinerated, destroyed. I mean, that was his biggest regret, was leaving that. And he didn't know. I mean, he had a fall at home. He got taken to hospital and got told at hospital he'll never return home. So he didn't have time to do anything or prepare anything.
I mean, that's a strange thing, isn't it? We all sort of think we might have time to prepare for this thing, but I would gather statistically most of us don't.
There is no time. And the other thing too is time is the commodity we can't purchase. Death can be around any corner. And I guess me being the coffin confessor, though, that's how I've prepared for death. I'm really prepared now.
Yeah.
Over the last few years, I'm prepared for my own death, but I'm prepared for if my loved ones die, someone really close to me, if they die now, sure, it's going to hurt and I'm going to be upset, but I'm prepared.
So you feel differently about death now, having done the work you do?
It's not that I envy the dead, but you've got to understand that they know what we don't, and it doesn't matter who says what, we're not going to know until we die. And I know more dead than alive, and it's a scary thing that we're all going, but if we embrace it and we look at it in a different light and we go, you know what, let's, instead of just, you know, living and then die, let's die living.
What did you do before you delivered confessions from the coffin?
Well, I'm a private investigator. I have been since 2007.
How did you get started as the coffin confessor? Was there a moment when it happened?
I told a dying man that I'd crash his funeral for him, and he took me up on the offer. And it was a joke. I seriously just said it as a joke. He did want something elaborate for his funeral, and I said, do a eulogy. Do your own eulogy. It should be great. And he said, no. He says, you know what? I've been to a couple of funerals of friends that did their own eulogy, and the family looked at it and said, no, we're not playing that. And that's when I said, well, I could always crash a funeral for you. And lo and behold, yeah, he took me up on the offer.
Did you stand up and deliver it? Did you interrupt the proceedings?
Yeah, I sit amongst family and friends as one of the mourners. A couple of people would come up and say, oh, how did you know Graham? And I'd say, we worked together. And we did. It wasn't a lie. And when his best mate's performing the eulogy, about 2 minutes in, Graham requested about 2-3 minutes in that I stand up.
Oh.
And I tell his best mate to sit down, shut up or fuck off, because Graham in the coffin's got something to say and this is what it is.
Oh my God, I'm actually feeling anxious. Like, were you feeling nervous before you did it that first time?
Oh, my arms were ringing. I was wet ass. I was just, yeah, for sure. So the best mate who left the podium and ran out, and Graham's brother, his sister-in-law and their child, who was told to stand up and leave because Graham hadn't seen him in 30 years, so why they were there paying their respects now when they could have come earlier. Anything else, it was a blur. It went pretty quick. And I'd rehearsed that letter quite a lot of times. So then I basically fold the letter back up, put it in an envelope, put it on the coffin, and I leave. So I don't know if the funeral continues. I have no idea. I just leave.
Did those people leave at your
direction? Oh, yeah, they left. And whilst some people might tell me to sit down or shut up myself, majority of people want to know what their loved one left unsaid. They want to hear it. They need to know. It's like anybody. It's a secret. What is it?
What keeps you going if and when you're feeling like this is hard?
I think what keeps me going is seeing the vultures in the family and the fake friends and the absolute bullshit that surrounds somebody on their deathbed. When I see that and I investigate it and I think, wow, that's just not on, that gives me the strength and determination to do right for these people. And it's sad that they need somebody like myself to do that. But at the end of the day, they have no trust. You know, they can't trust their friends, and they can't go directly and say it to the faces of these people because they're on their deathbed. Graham was lying there. He could see his best mate trying to screw his wife.
Mm.
He couldn't yell, kick or scream. He had nobody to defend his family. It was terrible.
It feels to me like truth justice, honesty, integrity, I'm trying to find some more words, would be really important to you personally?
Integrity, mostly. The truth and all that I find with my investigation skills, but I'll never, my integrity is everything. Honesty, obviously, because I hold people's secrets, their desires, their fantasies. They're very important to those people, and I've built up such a trust globally, not just here in Australia, but globally, that people send me their stories. Some of them are just horrendous. Some of them are so beautiful, and I can't wait to do the beautiful ones because there's some really, really nice ones. And it's across the board. You know, I can do good, bad, funny, sad.
How varied are the requests people make from you? I guess what are the sort of most beautiful ones you can remember? What are the strangest ones?
The most beautiful one would be a lady confessing her undying love for another lady. They were both married and they were both friends for eternity, and they had a secret desire. The only thing is they both had that secret desire and not one of them could tell the other. And they died not knowing, not telling each other, and it's a shame. But it was a beautiful moment because the husbands knew. Oh. The husbands actually knew this, but they never got together and spoke about it either.
Husbands were at the funeral?
One of the husbands.
One of the husbands.
Yeah. It was a beautiful moment. As far as the most in-your-face one would have been at a viewing, was pinpricking the body of a person that was petrified of being cremated alive.
So you had to go and pinprick the body because that person had said to you, I don't want to be cremated alive, can you make sure I'm dead?
Exactly, yeah. And since then people have said to me, look, this is what I want done at my viewing. You must pinprick my body, treat it like a pin cushion because I don't want to be buried alive. And now I'm getting a request to put mobile phones in coffins, photos, video, whatever it is, but mainly mobile phones in coffins.
Why?
People have this thing, especially if they're going to get buried, that they're going to have their phone because their phone's everything, photos, camera, light, communication. However, there's no communication down there.
You must have learnt so much about what we fear, what we're shameful of, what we hope for, what we hide. I can't imagine how much you've learnt about us as humans when it comes to that time of death.
Yeah, I love the animal kingdom more.
Do you? You have horses, right?
Horses, animals, yeah. I really do love the animal kingdom more after learning what I've learnt, because people can be so secretive, and it's usually the people that you would never have thought in a million years would be who they really are behind closed doors. It's a thing that I've found that it doesn't matter who it is. Every person on the planet has a skeleton in the closet. It's just a matter of if they want to let it out or not.
Does that make you look at people differently? Like, do you look at someone like me and think, I wonder what her real story is?
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. Because, I mean, because everyone I've met has a story, and every person on the planet has a story. And it could be big, it could be small. It doesn't matter what it is, but it's something. And this is the exciting part. One of my clients, his grandmother had died many years ago, and at the funeral, the wrong coffin arrived and nobody knew. So it was the wrong body. His biggest fear at his funeral was him not being there. And he said to me, I want to engage you just to walk up to the coffin, open it, check it's me, give the wife a heads up and walk out. That's it. And that's all that he wanted done, because he was petrified of this one thing that his grandmother had gone through.
How do you know what to charge? I mean, every job is so different. Mm.
Yeah, so if a funeral crash in a certain place, I tally up where I've got to go, accommodation and travel and all that. However, there are some cases where I haven't charged anything because the people I've met have just been absolutely beautiful people that haven't got a cent to their name, and they needed it done. I mean, one lady in particular who did take her own life, she wanted me to be her, I suppose, a suicide note is how she put it. But there was no one to give it to. There was nobody. No one attended her funeral. Not one person.
Gosh. So she was totally alone.
Totally alone. And her request was that her ashes be picked up and spread into the ocean. And no one was there to do that for her. So I took that upon myself to do that. You know, and no, she wasn't charged for that or anything before. You know, it was just something that had to be done. And, you know, from then on, I thought to myself, there's going to be a lot of people, lot of people that haven't got money. And whilst I say sometimes that my fees are between $2,000 and $10,000 and they don't need the money where they're going, and I never get a complaint. It's never really been about the money. I mean, I've done quite well through my life. I mean, my wife and I, we've been together since we were 15. It's nearly 40 years now. We lived in a tent with a child. I was in and out of jail. I was a terrible, terrible teenager, always trying to get ahead, but always going three steps back, one step forward. My whole life was abuse all the way through until I met, you know, my wife. I know what it's like to have nothing, absolutely nothing. And now, today, I know what it's like to have and to pay it forward and to give back.
Does it ever get a bit much? You're taking on a lot of people's pain, regret, shame, secrets. How do you unwind? How do you reset?
I don't have a reset button, or, you know, I just keep going. I've never been one to stop. I've just always kept going. It's like when I took on the church and the school, I never gave up. I just kept going. I refused to give up. And I suppose my whole life's been like that.
Let's talk about this. You fought this battle for justice on behalf of former students at the elite, the Southport School on the Gold Coast. This was against the Anglican Church over historic sexual and physical abuse. You were a former student at the school. This was a very personal case for you, wasn't it?
I was living in government housing at the age of 12 and won a five-year fully funded scholarship to the Southport School. And from day one, I was sexually, physically and mentally abused for years. No one would believe me. No one believed me. And then I think it was 1997, Peter Jackson, who was Australian rugby league legend, played for Australia. He came out and said I was being abused at TSS, the Southport School. And then he killed himself. And I went, that's not going to happen to me. And as sad as it was, I was happy to know I wasn't the only one. And as bad as that may sound to people, it gave me hope and gave me the strength and courage to know that there was more than just me and Peter. And there is.
What was it like when you were trying to be heard and you're saying this happened and no one believed you?
It was terrible. I was being threatened with arrest. I was being called a liar. It was the most horrific time. And even when the later years, in the last, say, 5 years, it just got worse because lawyers got involved. And if you haven't got a lawyer that can go into bat for you and be really strong, you're basically all stuffed. And lawyers are scared of the church. I don't care who they are, they're scared of going up against the church because it's not about justice, it's about money. And some of these institutions, especially the Southport School on the Gold Coast, their money pit is just too deep. They always said to me that they can bury this and it can go on for decades till you die. And I said, well, I'm not giving up. So I started the Facebook page, Lost Boy of TSS, and hundreds of boys came forward. And it was too much for the school, too much for the church. And then they listened to my story. And then the internet came about with Facebook and that. So I think that was, 2011 or 12 or something, I started the page. And that really took off. And then boys were coming forward and saying, hey, I know you. I was also abused at the school. And they'd send their story through. And I'd investigate these stories. Mm. And I'd send them through to the police. And the police ended up saying to me, if we investigate this, it's going to open Pandora's box. And we haven't got the resources to investigate this. Let's just hope the church pays you out and you will go away. I'm like, you're kidding. So, like I've always said, I didn't get justice, but I got revenge.
Where is it at? I think there's been a recent settlement.
Yeah, I ended up accepting a settlement. I've got to be honest, the settlement was for my wife. We've been together 40 years. She's been carrying this and carrying me for 40 years. And I've had the boy inside the man, so to speak, fighting. I'm fighting for this boy. And then all of a sudden, I accept the settlement and the boy says, goodbye, you're on your own. And it was a big moment for me because my wife and I just looked at each other and we're like, it's over. Holy shit. How cool's that? Like, it was just an amazing feeling. I mean, I was vindicated for sure. I never got the justice because the perpetrators, the teachers, three of the teachers, one's now deceased, the other two can still teach to this day. And I find that disgusting and horrific that they're able to continue to be able to teach. I mean, it's just wrong.
Now, is it true that there's a series in production about you? If you say I can't comment on that, then it's true.
I'm not at liberty to say.
Fair enough. Let's say there were a series. Who would be the ideal person to play Bill Edgar?
Oh, look, this is a question I got asked many times, is who would play my role. And obviously in the States, I named a couple of people. But funny enough, these days, they're circling around and they're talking about a woman.
Really?
Yeah.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. It's quite unique and different, and it's empowering, and I like it.
When you're not crashing funerals, I know you have your two horses. What do you do off duty?
I have the grandchildren. So I have six grandchildren under four, so they take up my world at the moment, my wife and I. My wife had a really bad accident a couple of years ago, and she's just learnt to walk and provide for herself again, which is really cool. And she's even got back on the horse, which scares the crap out of me. But what do they say? If you fall off the horse, you've got to get back on it.
She's literally done that.
So she literally does that.
Gosh, that's probably been a tough couple of years for you and your family.
She's come through and she's got a permanent disability from it, but it hasn't stopped her from doing what she wants to do in life. And she saved me when I was a child and all the way through life. So, you know, we just bounce off each other.
It sounds like you've got an incredible partnership.
It's crazy, isn't it? People would say to me, how long have you been together? I'd say, oh, nearly 40 years. And they go, 40 years? Like, how does that happen? And I'm like, well, I don't know. I'm blessed.
Is this where you thought your life would end up? Does it make sense in retrospect?
It definitely makes sense. Did I ever think I'd be where I am today? No. I still drive past the building that I stood on the rooftop of Surfers Paradise and nearly leapt off when I was 16. To being abused and no one listened to me, and it was just a horrendous time. And I remember saying to my girlfriend Lara at the time, I said, you know, I just can't do it anymore. And I remember going to the rooftop of this high rise and sitting right on the rooftop looking over the edge. My legs were dangling over the edge, and you know what, I've had enough. And just as I was about to go, I saw this family playing tennis on the tennis court, two little kids, toddlers, and mum and dad playing tennis. And I thought, that's just what I want. I want that. That's what I want. I want a family. And there's no way I want that family to see what I'm about to do. I said to Lara, and back then we didn't have technology or anything. Lara's looking for me everywhere, and I'd end up finding her, and she'd say, what happened? I told her, because I was pretty upfront. She said, let's start a family.
That's extraordinary.
That young, it was amazing. Yeah, it was a pivotal moment. It was a moment I'll never forget. And it still comes back to my wife. When the day she first met me, I mean, I stole a school uniform and walked into her school. I was living on the streets. I was a street kid. And I walked into this classroom, introduced myself to the teacher as a new student. I sat down, and Lara had told her best friends, sitting in the row of chairs, I'm going to marry that boy one day.
No way.
She fell in love instantly, she said.
The best love story of all time. I can imagine you just love being with your grandkids.
Yeah, what a feeling. Yeah, absolutely. I'm blessed. But I mean, I am with our children too. My wife and I and my son and my daughter, we were very strong, and we are today. It's never been broken. We've always, and if there has been broken anyway, we mend it really quickly. And it's the same now with the grandchildren. It's just, it's beautiful.
When you get to the end of your life, whenever that might be, do you think you will feel a sense of real achievement from where you've come from, what you've come through, what you've done for others?
Yeah, I think so. I want to. My legacy, I hope, is that the underdog was helped, assisted, and they're no longer the underdog. I showed them the light and I helped them out and I went into bat for them. And I hope that my children, which they do see that, but I hope my grandchildren have that in them as well, that if they see injustice or see something wrong, stand up, say something. It doesn't matter if you get caught a whistleblower, whatever it is, does not matter. But if there's an injustice, it can be done. And one person can change the world. I had no idea that they could. I'm living proof. I'm the only coffin confessor on the planet, and I'm changing the world.
Bill, it has been such a pleasure to see you again. Thank you so much for dropping by.
Thank you so much for having me, and hi to all your listeners.
You've been listening to Insightful, an 8-part series from SBS, recorded in Sydney, Australia, on the land of the Gadigal people. Insightful is produced by Felicity Davey, Cassandra Allen, and Kate Harassi, and edited by Maddox Foster. If you enjoyed this episode, please stay tuned for more. Until next time, I'm Kumi Taguchi. Thanks so much for your company.